Hi Earthlings, and welcome to another episode of the Mother Earth Heroes podcast. This is the podcast where we speak with people designing companies, products, and services that are creating a better world. You get to hear how they ideated, prototyped, and tested their ideas and the impact that they want to have in the world. Now we'll continue our series on food. And when we look on our supermarket shelves, we see a mind-boggling array of goods. The products have come from all corners of the world. Now this has offered us an amazing amount of choice, but also has a substantial impact on the planet. It's estimated that the US average produce travels around about 1,500 miles or 2,500 kilometers. Now this greatly increases CO2 emissions, but also means that the goods are harvested before they're ripe, placed in high energy consuming refrigeration units, and in some cases are even chemically treated to prolong their shelf life. The resulting food has significantly less nutritional value, taste, and we also have a high level of waste, 40% in the US and over 30% in Europe. So what can we do to tackle this challenge? And how can we bring a farm into a city, or a Stadt, as they say in Germany? This is what our guest Anne-Kathrin Kuhlmann has done in Berlin with Stadtfarm. Anne-Kathrin has created a circular aquaterraponic farm in Berlin that will be opening a second one soon. Her farm produces 50 tons of African catfish and 30 tons of lettuce, herbs, tomatoes and cucumbers, as well as exotic foods such as bananas and passion fruit, all whilst using 80% less water, 80% less land and reducing CO2 emissions by 85%. So in this episode, you will hear how Anne-Kathrin prototyped the concept initially on the office balcony, how they managed to finance and scale the initial farm, the challenges you face when Google incorrectly lists your location, and in this case, in a graveyard, and how they had to innovate their business model due to COVID. This and, of course, so much more. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Anne-Kathrin Kuhlmann from Stadtfarm.
My very first internship right after out of high school was in a really small IT startup. And then I kind of got stuck there, kept in touch with them throughout my university time. Actually left university for a year for a while in the IT boom to go work there. And then actually set up my own first company even while I was still at uni. So that kind of, you know, that was actually me. I was the entrepreneur before I became the consultant. And I think that's important because a lot of, you know, it's kind of a different mindset than if you're a consultant per se. And I was always really active in NGOs of all kind of different kinds and often very frustrated because my attempts to professionalize processes in these NGOs were always met with this kind of exasperation of saying, why do we all like each other and this is going great and we're all drinking tea together, so this is fine. I was like, no, we're totally inefficient and we need to be achieving more and we need to set goals and blah, blah, blah. And so actually when I kind of stumbled across the whole social entrepreneurship, social business world or terms, which were like fairly new 15 years ago, I was like, that's what I want to be. You know, that's where okay. I need to be. This is the two different parts of me all in one.
Yeah.
And it kind of just felt like that's where that was the space I had been looking for all the time, actually.
That's the point where I think we just jumped forward to, is that at some point you started thinking about potential ideas. You've got this social entrepreneurial, you've had some experience at running business, you've been CEO of another business as well. But then suddenly you said, okay, I'm going to do something. When did food become a potential? You had spoken before we started the call, you said you had a farming background.
Food seriously became an issue when I became a mom, actually when I got pregnant. That's when I started seriously thinking about what am I putting into my body and started going fully organic and stuff like that. It was kind of aware of it before, but, you know, maybe not taking it fully seriously yet. And so food, as in what do I eat and how does it affect my health, had been an issue for quite a while. And then when I'd been involved in whatever around the whole sustainability topic for several years, food is like probably the area with the largest impact. If you want to look at for the one single area where you can have the most impact, food and especially meat consumption is it, you know, considering what are we going to do next? What kind of startup do I want to do that will really have a positive effect on the whole planet and everybody's lives? It was pretty obvious of what I wanted, what area we had to look for.
Okay. So it's okay. We're very much clear. We've, as you say, I've been through this sort of experience as well. The children come and all of a sudden you're, oh my goodness, we've got to think about.
What do I tell them when they're 18, you know?
Yeah. but then the actual idea that you've come up with, you must have come up with, gone through a few ideas to try and come to arrive where you did. What was that sort of process like?
It was more indirect because we were constantly or are constantly screening sort of innovations from around the world, everything to do with sustainability in all sorts of areas, because to me, sustainability is a very holistic issue, right? So you can't just look at just energy or just, you know, transportation, or you have to kind of have an awareness at least of all the different areas. I knew all these beautiful projects in tropical countries called from integrated farming is what they call it. Mm. We're on a much larger scale than what we're doing today. They really integrate all the nutrients and all the sort of materials flows in the entire farms. But that works in the tropics because you never have winter, so your biology never stops, right? Your whole biological process is continuous. And I also knew aquaponics in the traditional sense of what it had been since the 70s of, well, having some fish and some lettuce or tomatoes or some whatever greens. But it was a very much the same linear process you have in farming as when, say, the dairy farmer dumps his manure on the field. Yeah. You know, it doesn't have anything to do with actual closing the cycle, trying to... You know, it's not particularly sustainable and innovative. I like the idea of having aquaponics because you're squishing things on, you know, you're compromising, you're unable to have high yields on a smaller scale. But I also wanted to have the integrated nutrient cycles, the whole biology and ecology of that. And then we just started testing it. We just took our company balcony and put 10 square meters mini greenhouse on it and just said, let's go.
So literally started prototyping the concept there. And obviously this idea of circularity, a circular design was really important to you. When did you start thinking you were being able to close that circle? When did you, from your little greenhouse on the balcony to thinking, maybe we should scale this up a bit more?
Well, the idea was always to say, if you want to do this, you have to scale it because you want to be on a commercial scale, right? Yeah. I'm not convinced that we can get everyone to be self-sufficient on every level. We're gonna continue having people who are experts at certain things. The idea, you know, you prototype just to be able to see does the ground principle work. Then you go a bit larger. We went to roughly 100 square meters in a greenhouse in a gardening school, actually, because then we said, well, there are certain elements we want to test, say the soils we're using, what ratio fish to plants, and all these things. That we said we really want to test it before you go commercial, of course, and you want to test it for several seasons. Most of what's out there right now at the universities, they actually literally just go for one season and then they say, oh, we've got all our data now, we can sort of deconstruct it. And say, but you have long-term effects, you want to be studying those, whoa. So we ran that for 3 years, actually. And then in parallel, so started looking for the places we like potential locations for commercial sites. So the continuous evolution, we were really going for circularity from the beginning, because that was sort of the whole point of what are we doing different than, you know, what's already there and technology wise.
And then I guess, so we've got this long process of sort of, I suppose, as you say, I know within sort of agriculture, you've got those long cycles. You can't really speed it up. We have to work with nature here. but we also have to work with investors and get people on board. Now, obviously, you're very charming, but it's going to be a lot of money to get to actually come up with the setup of this particular at a larger scale. How did that come about, and how was that?
We had a consulting business based on sort of for sustainability consulting that was still being run by my husband, actually. The whole time, and we were just basically funneling the money we were making there into the pilot. That okay. helps, of course, when you have your own money to put in. And then we had friends and family serve as a first step, your classical first step. Yeah. And that was enough to get the bank on board for the first site, for the first commercial plant. And then we went into crowdfunding to go, or crowd lending, actually, to say, hey, this is now visible. It's there. You can touch it. It's not theoretical. Let's take the next steps with the crowd.
How was that for that first stage? So you've gone, okay, now we're ready to do it. What was the most challenging thing in those early setup stage?
Convincing the bank, actually, because the banks, at least in Germany, are so risk averse. Actually, officially, they tell you that they're not allowed to take risks at all. They're like, okay, so you first prove us the technology. So you prove the technology. Oh, but yeah, that's easy. But what about the commercial side? You know, there's always a but. It was actually fairly frustrating at some point to say, guys, first you said, don't worry about the commercial stuff. You know, we don't think you'll get the technology, right? Then we prove you the technology and you go backwards and say, no, but now we're not sure you'll be able to sell. So, I think Germany in general is fairly risk averse and
I think that's understated.
so we love insurance policies for everything. when you tell them, no, this is possible. I know science says the opposite. I know everyone's publishing the opposite, but we've proven this, you know, you can trust us. You just have to be very persistent. In the end, that's it.
But then you actually started, I suppose, the first season and the actual, in effect, this is still at this stage, a sort of prototype. So what went well at that stage and what was perhaps less, or perhaps more disappointing or challenging?
It was actually, I'd say it's pretty normal. You have things that are unexpected. Like for example, we at first did not expect the site to be like so remote for people's points of view. So we thought we'd have more sort of B2C traffic on a regular basis, and then realized that Google actually maps it wrong. So it's great on the map, but if you navigate with Google, you end up in the cemetery. We were losing customers all the time who got stuck and couldn't find us. So stupid things like that, that you really weren't counting on. You know, you're thinking of all your normal processes that you can actually control, but there's these things that are completely beyond your control. And Google to this day has not managed to correct that.
Wow.
So we now have like maps and maps and maps everywhere that we, you know, even if we send a taxi, someone comes with a taxi, we're like, no. Oh, take a different house number. Because we literally sometimes wait, you know, hours for people to get to the appointment and stuff. It's so that was something, for example, we had not been counting on at all. And therefore, that shifted, of course, our distribution focus completely, fairly quickly. Yeah.
So how would you that? Because I suppose at that stage, you're still sort of developing the business model. You had initially a focus on sort of a B2C model, but then we're suddenly realizing actually we're gonna have to change this.
B2B, yeah.
B2B is gonna have to be. So how would you describe your business model now?
There was another big change exactly 1 year ago, right? So because we went B2B and focused very much on restaurants, certain level of delivery, but more like lunch, meal times, because that sort of thing for offices in the area. And then came COVID and the lockdown, and suddenly our B2B went zilch.
Of course, yes.
So we said, okay, darn, let's go back to the drawing board here and really refocus completely on B2C. In a location that's not ideal for it. So we'd already tested that. So we have managed to actually turn it around now, but it's taken a whole year to get, you know, to the profitability we actually had before, which is very annoying. But we've proven that you can do B2C in impossible locations. That's nice. But we also focused a lot more on our subscription and delivery model product. So we just expanded that range hugely. We turned our small, you know, farmer's market into really a mini organic store and that kind of thing. So and also experimented with, you know, what products will work, what doesn't. I find it nice, but also amazing that people actually really can lock our brand to, like, they link it to a regional product. Okay. So if we offer lemons, they just won't buy them. because that's not from here. but I think that's positive. But first we were like, oh, we're gonna have to now offer a bit of everything. You know, people will be coming shopping here and want the one stop shop. But no, they actually do want regional products from us.
How would you describe those customers? Do you have like a sort of a persona that you could sort of identify, or is it sort of a lot broader? Or
it's fairly broad, since it's. So there's a certain majority that has a certain consciousness for, you know, or awareness, you know, it's more sustainable, more regional food. But there is actually a lot of people, because we're in Lichtenberg, you know, we're not in, say, the most, you know, this is not the most prestigious place to be when you're trying to sell, let me say, some sort of premium food or something. So we do have just perfectly normal neighbors who come by who say, "Hey, I remember this place 50 years ago, blah, 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 blah. You know, my husband used to work here," and whatever. So it's very much your average normal person. And I like that. And we also have, generally in shopping and in groceries, you will have more female deciders, right? But we actually, because it's fish and therefore meat, it's the percentage is not as high as it could be. So it's also male driven, which is also an interesting challenge and mix, because, you know, constantly, do I address the male or the female mindset?
You talked about a brand that people really buy into. They like it. They love it. It's this regional thing. Is that expanding? Is that something you can sort of, I suppose, grow in itself?
Right now, our goal is to be in just about every larger area where there's people, right? The challenge is actually right now that people want our produce everywhere, and we're always saying, well, okay, we can ship, but it's not really what we want to be doing, right? So it's actually the other way around. People are demanding for it in Munich and London and wherever, and we're saying, we're not there yet. We're not supposed to be selling to you yet. And then they go, but please, please, please do. So we have the online shop, and you can have it shipped with UPS Express, but we don't focus on that area, because we actually do prefer just staying true to the brand of actually reaching people in our vicinity, right?
I suppose this is the thing about the localization. You've got every year 50 tons of African catfish, 30 tons of lettuce, herbs, tomatoes, cucumbers, exotic plants such as bananas, passion fruit. How many people can a farm such as this, feed, as it were?
Theoretically, if you're taking just your meat consumption and theoretically substituting it all with our fish, you'd have roughly 500 people. And on the vegetable side, actually only about 200 that we could feed.
Yeah.
So this is cute. Yeah. We can have thousands of farms and still be in like a 1% market share or something.
Yeah.
But I think that's also the positive part, because, you know, we're radically different, but we're not hurting anybody, right? So
yeah, and also I suppose the other idea about localization is you're not only creating a feeding the local population, you're also employing the population. How does that work? How many people do you need for a stadt farm? How many?
So we have roughly 20 people now, not all full-time though, because we actually close the value chain, right? So we do from propagation, from actually planting our baby seeds down to delivering to the doorstep, is all the whole value chain, you know, the processing, the kitchen, everything is internal. That's different from most farms who just produce, you know, a raw product, and then the actual value gain happens other places, right? Besides the fact that it's not very profitable to just produce lettuce and then have someone else sell it for you, it's also not really feasible. And the whole point of being in the city and in an urban space is so that people can come and see and understand and get back in touch with what food means and how food comes to be, right? Milk does not grow in Tetra Paks, and nor does steak come in, you know, is kind of born in this in some plastic bag. So, you know, we want people to get some sort of idea of how food actually grows, and that it is seasonal. You know, even though we are in a greenhouse, we're happy to have no tomatoes for a few months in the year and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's scary how much out of touch people have gotten with food.
Okay, so this is another core, is an educational aspect to the job. Okay, one thing I was thinking about, because there's the monitoring aspect, because it's a very closed system. I mean, how do you monitor something like that? Because I imagine if there was, say, a pest or an infection or something, it could be devastating for a closed system.
So system health is something we monitor, but more on the ecological general level, because our fish are, they're not overbred because they're not such a common species. So they're really robust, right? They're just like us. They're small, short, so others are tall, others are, you know, some are fat, some are slim. They're very varied. That makes them more robust. So if, as long as you're providing a healthy living environment, they're basically going to stay healthy. Yeah. And we've not had any pests or problems like actual fish diseases in the system ever. Mm. And we've been doing it a while.
So. Yeah. No, I was just wondering how that works.
So we are, what we do monitor is water quality, because that's really essential for the fish. And we just have to make sure that we're always, you know, this whole cycle of the plants really filtering the water is always continuing and doesn't stop, so that we have nice and healthy fish. But it's extremely stable once you get nature to let nature do its job. So, I mean, we've had three horrible summers, right, where we were all like, we privately were all going, oh my God, please let me go away. And in the greenhouse, I mean, it's worse. It's 50 degrees for weeks and it doesn't cool off. There's no wind. And the only thing we didn't do is put in baby lettuces for a while, because they would really suffer it, you know, at that temperature. But apart from that, everything was stable and healthy and fine. So it shows you how resilient an ecosystem is once you let it be an ecosystem, rather than thinking we're so smart, we will do all the fiddling around because we know better.
Yeah. Okay. So don't interrupt a working system functions in nature as much as it does in IT. Okay. But then you set up BeFood, the AG, which is, I guess, the idea of scaling this beyond. You've obviously got demand. You've got a lot of media attention. People are saying, when are you going to open a farm in our city? How do you do that? What are those next steps? Because I know you're opening another farm in a second location in Rommelsburger Bucht. How do you want to talk about the scaling then and the next steps?
So in Berlin, we're going to operate the farms ourselves so far. But we have partners in Hamburg and Munich already, where we're scouting locations. And that's also been a bit set back for due to Corona, because appointments got canceled and but in general, we're already scouting and have like pretty promising locations where we want to go there. And we have interest from all different, like lots of different other cities. And the idea is right now to go in joint ventures. Mm-hmm. So that you always have someone on site who's really just as entrepreneurial and committed and running the operations. But long term, you could probably franchise it, but that would be unrealistic when you have, you know, until you have maybe 10 or 20 farms up and running.
Okay, so the business model is just to seek other partners and then provide them with the insights, the skills,
and we train them.
I suppose ultimately, then franchise or whatever it is, it's still, you have a working system. By the second farm, we are absolutely sure of the smooth setup. We can now help others to do it. I mean, this seems like it should be something that's more of a policy level, being supported by government, as it were, to try and localize foods or local cities or something. You would feel like there would be maybe some support. Is that the case?
There's lots of support from local politics, in the sense that they're super excited about what we're doing. Of course, they have regulations that we have to stick to, and that's fine. I mean, we're producing food and food should be safe, right? I can live with red tape to the extent that, you know, we know it's there. It's not something that comes as a surprise. And, you know, you stick to the rules, you talk to authorities to kind of take them along the ride, you know, on the journey to guide you and advise you on, you know, if you want to change something, and then really see it as a partnership. That we do have cities approaching us sometimes to say, hey, we have lots of space, don't you want to come here? That doesn't mean, of course, that they're going to give us the money to set up there. So there's obviously limits to what politics can really do for us in that sense. on this, in the sense that politics should actually be pushing towards more local food, etc., I'm always saying the first thing our government needs to do is actually apply its own rules to itself, which is, you know, people buy more green, reduce your CO2, etc. Because if the largest buyer in the nation, the government, did it, then there'd be tons of products that would be much cheaper because you get scales, you know, economies of scale in the green sector. So I'm not really expecting them to like specifically support us in that sense, but rather just maybe do their own green sourcing.
Yeah. I suppose it is that like question of scale. At the end of the day, if you're saying that you're these are very small in effect, the number of people that we can feed and so whatever. But at the same time, I suppose the hope is that we bring more resources into cities, make them greener, make them more attractive. I think there's the garden city concept is something that's kind of growing in mentality, and getting back to nature will be very good. So who knows? Hopefully that would be something that comes about. Pretty much wrapping up. There's a couple of last ones, which was again for Anna-Katrine. One of the questions I was going to ask you, how's your life changed since 2015 when you started this? At all? Changed a bit?
I mean, lots of things have changed. I mean, I was an entrepreneur before, so it's not that per se things change hugely in the way that, you know, I'm a workaholic. I have always have been. I mean, what we do see is that media attention is rising, and I think COVID especially has brought a certain like a real leap and more awareness to these kind of topics, that it's not something we all think, oh, yay, nice, it's happening. Oh, how good, someone else is taking care of it. But that it's something, you know, we urgently need. We do feel that, and we do see that. And so that impacts my day more than others. Mm. Apart from that, what's changed is we eat more local healthy food ourselves because it's just available. Yeah. That's, you know, it's always like nice when you can self benefit from what you're doing. And lots of friends and family who are constantly saying, oh, bring some food. Yeah, but I wouldn't say like there's a big change in my daily life. But it's transitioned a lot, of course. I mean, in the beginning, I was very much hands on the farm myself. That changed now. I mean, we have tons of people doing their jobs, and sometimes I'm not sure I actually know how to work the cash machine anymore. So,
okay. About one question: what do you know now to be untrue that you thought to be true before you started this?
Maybe not untrue, but I think what you learn as an entrepreneur, the one thing you always learn is patience, because you're always thinking things will move much faster, and then you already add like 100% of extra time on top into your plans, and it still needs longer. Like just to get the building permit for Romo's book, it's taken us a year, right? So it's like, oh my God.
Okay.
We thought we'd be through in 3 months, and then, yeah, there we go. So, because I mean, it's the same authorities, it's the same office that already said you can go in Hatzbaga. So we were like, why is this taking so long?
Okay.
I think that's really the thing of you're always optimistic about time plans as an entrepreneur, and thinking, oh, and next year we'll be there and there and there, and it'll be super fast. And things always take longer. I think that's one big learning that's a constant reality. But if you're not an optimistic kind of person who says, I don't know, we're going to push through and we will get there eventually, then entrepreneurship is not for you.
Absolutely. I suppose, what do you see? I suppose, what's the big dream for the next 10 years? Where would you like to be further down the road?
Global.
This optimistic.
Definitely global. So, I mean, we will be, you know, doing the third and fourth plant next year in Germany. And from that point on, I think we have proven then, you know, this is scalable. This actually does transfer to different locations. And we have interest from tons of different countries. So I think the dream for the next 10 years is to really find the partners that help us scale this globally, because it might not be ourselves, but I'm okay with letting the baby grow and, you know, grow up as long as we reach, you know, millions and millions of people, because I think it's so important. Sometimes really strange questions we get from customers, which are more like a mirror of where society is today with what people know or don't know about food anymore. And it's, so I think this reaching more people and having this transparent farm, you know, in the neighborhoods, they can actually learn and reconnect to the realities of food are so, so important.
There was a spoof advert in the 1950s where they did the spaghetti harvest in Italy, and it went on TV on April Fool's Day, and everyone believed it. But recently they asked public again, and it was still around about 20% of people thought spaghetti grew on trees in the UK. So we really haven't got a clue, have we?
Yeah, and also, I mean, people still think that farming has to do with, you know, this guy in the green jacket going out and putting his hands in the ground. And the reality is there's tractors the size of houses, you know, across the fields today. And it's a lot more technical and, IT driven, really. And it's super centralized. You know, there might be two processors for potatoes in all of northern Germany or something. And it's, so people have this really romantic idea of the little cow with its bell walking across the field, you know? But they don't. And we need to find ways to sort of bridge that gap in reality and knowledge. Otherwise, you know, people won't change their behavior if they don't actually know why it's important.
And what do you think, so you would say to say someone listening to this would be the biggest change or thing that they could do to have some impact, as it were?
Plan your meals ahead when you go shopping so you're not wasting, because we all throw away food sometimes, we know that, and we throw away on average 30%. So if we save some of that, use the money you save to buy better meat, like high quality meat, like from animals that actually had a good life, and then only eat good meat, like once or twice a week, or fish from Stadt Farm, of course. Then you've done like a hell of a lot to reduce your footprint, and you're saving the planet, and you're doing a lot of good things for your body as well. So it's a win-win.
Okay. Yep. Well, I can second that. I think when you start buying organic meat, you can only afford it once or twice a week. Yeah. So it's when you realize that a 2 euro chicken from Aldi compared to a 25 euro chicken from the organic store, there must be something wrong here.
Yeah. Even veggies are more expensive than the meat. You have to think about what that animal ate.
Yeah, exactly. Excellent. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time. And it's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thank you.
I think this is a great example of social entrepreneurship, where from the beginning on, circularity and sustainability have been the driving forces. At this stage, the business is relatively small, but it appears to be really a scalable model, so it'll be interesting to see how the next couple of years are. Now, I grew up in the countryside, as did Anne-Catherine, and I now live in Berlin with my three children. And I think the benefit for me is also that reconnection with our food and where it comes from, and also truly having fresh produce. So you can find out much more about aquaterraponics and the amazing work that Anne-Catherine and her team are doing at Stadt Farm. That's www.stadtfarm.de. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did with Anne-Catherine. In the meantime, I just want to say a quick thanks to Nikolai Grabit for his support and inspiration. Thanks to Paul Fife, the amazing podcast editor. You can check him and his music out at paulfife.com. Thanks to Maria for her outstanding research and optimism. And of course, a big thanks to Bettina, my wife, and kids for all their support. I look forward to bringing you more amazing guests soon on the Mother Earth Hero Show. And in the meantime, don't forget to save the planet. We need to do it sooner rather than later.